Morning, everybody. My name is Jane Bolden, and I teach at the Royal Military College of Canada. I'd like to just begin by thanking the CSDS for putting together such a fabulous day of discussion. It's been quite impressive. And I see my role here as discussing. I'm just going to take a particular aspect of Dr. Wedgwood's remarks and sort of use the UN Security Council as a window through which to build on some of the things she said and raise a few specific questions that maybe will open the way for further discussion. The idea that the Security Council is a legal actor when it comes to counterterrorism at the international level is not a necessarily a given. There are lots of people who would take issue with that. But there has been a lot of discussion, particularly in the international law literature lately, about the Security Council taking a legislative role. And as opposed to some other areas of what we would call international peace and security, we particularly see that on this counterterrorism response in the Security Council. So I'm going to start with that as a kind of a given, and I recognize, but I also want to say right off the top, I recognize that you could take issue with that. In playing that role, the Security Council has acted in a variety of ways. They've set baseline standards for state action. They've taken reactive, punitive approach, sanctions being one example. And they've used the state itself, in effect, as both a standard and a tool for its own strategy to deal with terrorism at the international level. And it has reached, you know, not just used it as a tool, but reached through it or beyond it, depending on the image you want to use, right down to the level of the individual, as Dr. Wedgwood talked about, targeting individuals directly, which is a very innovative move for the Security Council. So that sort of backdrop, I think, raises a number of dilemmas, creates a number of tensions for the UN Security Council, and contributes in some ways to some of the themes in the first panel about the blurring of the lines between what's internal to a state and what's international or external to a state, and how do you deal with that blurring, and where do you draw the line when we're talking about these kinds of non-state actors? So my overarching question is, if we accept again that the Security Council is a international law legal actor here, what is the nature of the measures or the law that they are putting into place? Who is making the law, and on what basis? Right. So, in the first instance, one of the things to know about how the Security Council has reacted to terrorism is that it's not a strategy that has at its base the idea that this, in terms of counterterrorism, that terrorism can be deterred. Right? It's a reactive strategy. It's geared, on the one hand, to punishing the actors to the extent that's possible, but on the other hand, to strengthening states' capabilities when it comes to their ability to respond or prevent or control terrorist activity. So Security Council resolutions stress the need to control borders, the need to control citizens, non-citizens within those borders, the need to control assets relating to weapons of mass destruction, and so on. It's a very sort of state-centric approach in that sense, but it also carries implicitly and to some extent explicitly within it a push for capacity building in states and in a particular group of states. We could all kind of guess who they're thinking of when they're looking out and saying states need to reach certain standards and controlling financial flows and citizens and so on. What's come with that, and again, Dr. Wedgwood referenced this as well, is a whole administrative, in effect, structure that is also relatively new and innovative for the Security Council, primarily associated with the CTC, the Counterterrorism Committee, of where states report to the committee. There are state visits, there are cooperative arrangements, there are links to regional organizations. There are now in-house experts for the Security Council. Again, another shift that, you know, not so long ago would have been seen as impossible. Because of the push between, push isn't quite the right word, the linkage, say, between information and what we would might, in other terms, call intelligence gathering, right, which is a real flashpoint at the United Nations. But all of this to say that we're now seeing the Security Council, in effect, as the center and at the center of, in some ways, a very large information gathering exercise. There are a lot of questions associated with that. So one of my first question, not one of, my first question is, what are the implications of, or are there implications stemming from the Security Council role in this way? And what are they, and how should we be thinking about those implications? And it's both at the state level and for the at the level of the individual, because of that reaching through of the council to target individuals directly. So the second sort of category and question I have has to do with the use of force, criminality, and self-defense. Gain picks up a little on something Dr. Wedgwood raised, but the question is, should international terrorism, and I'm using that phrase deliberately, be seen as a criminal activity or as an aggressive act on the level of state conflict and war? Raise that because it's often a debate that's left aside in the midst of all these other big questions. Day after September 11th, the Security Council passed Resolution 1368, which recognized, even though they didn't need to because it's in the Charter, but recognized the inherent right to self-defense. And so the U.S. coalition that went to war in Afghanistan did so, in effect, under that self-defense rubric. But that raises a lot of questions about how we view terrorism at the international level. Do we view it as a state-to-state kind of enterprise? If not, how does self-defense apply, for how long, in what context, and so on? Some of the similar kinds of questions that Dr. Wedgwood raised, but coming at it in a different angle. Another way to think of it is, had the circumstances been different after September 11th, where the cells or the groups who had launched the attacks not been located in Afghanistan and so clearly associated with the Taliban government, but had they been in Hamburg and London, somewhere in the United States, Canada, who would we have gone to war against? And how would we have categorized it as self-defense? I don't have an answer to that, but I just use that as a sort of hypothetical to get us thinking about the issues associated with whether we're talking about a criminal kind of activity or whether we're talking about a conflict, war kind of activity, and the dilemmas that that raises. The third set of issues I want to raise or question have to do with the targeting of individuals. Can we envisage, or do we want to envisage, the Security Council moving beyond the targeting of individuals associated with al-Qaeda to individuals associated with other groups? And what kind of problems and dilemmas does that raise? This was highlighted, if you like, when the Security Council passed Resolution 1566 after the Beslan attacks. Russia made a push to try and get the Security Council to consider targeting or making a list of individuals associated with other terrorist groups. It was one way for them to try and push what most people would consider to be, quote-unquote, a domestic terrorist issue onto an international terrorist agenda. It didn't work, but it raises the broader issue. Why, if we're going to approach try and counter terrorism at the international level in this way with al-Qaeda, do we not do it with other groups? And depending on your answer to that, can we envisage that somewhere down the line we might do it in different ways and for other groups? So I'll stop there, and hopefully some food for thought. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Let me start by suggesting that human rights, in the sense that Dr. Wedgwood mentioned initially, the protection against private violence, is not an absolute. It cannot be an absolute, because the logic of that is that there is no acceptable level of terrorism. And if we say that, then if there is any terrorism at all, we have to keep escalating the level of countermeasures we employ until the violence stops. That seems to me a very, very troubling argument. Which brings me to my major point. We don't ask enough, how much does terrorism matter? Is it a strategic threat, or is it an irritant? Now, different countries are going to have different answers to that question at different times, but the way that you answer that question is going to have a profound effect in terms of the countermeasures that you say are acceptable at any given time. That in itself is problematic, however, because it presumes that you are able to move along a spectrum of countermeasures relatively quickly. That's highly problematic, it's highly debatable, and it's also questionable whether in all cases you have sufficient foreknowledge of a change in the situation that enables you to move along that spectrum. So we have a real problem there. But we also have a problem, it seems to me, in suggesting that it's acceptable for a regime of extraordinary legal measures to exist in counterterrorism. Because it's likely to exist in perpetuity. After a major attack, it obviously is not going to be possible for any democratic government to do nothing. That, we have to understand that that's essentially off the table for a variety of very obvious reasons. Yet it's also the case that extraordinary legal measures, while they may improve counterterrorism, also substantially diminish the scope for people, for individuals, to be found innocent under those measures. It makes it more difficult to sort of to be found innocent within that system. Obviously, things such as the Bill of Rights, the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, provide some protection. But that's a long-term protection. The length of time it takes for a case to get to the Supreme Court is actually fairly long in many cases. As I've already suggested, most extraordinary legal measures dealing with counterterrorism are long-lasting. Laura Donahue's a law professor at Georgetown, and she's made a study of counterterrorism legislation, and it's very clear, if you read her work, that because you have to prove a negative threat, an absence of threat, the majority of emergency powers or extraordinary legislation remains on the books for a long time, and you become essentially dependent on judicial interpretation as a means of a application. That, again, seems problematic. The example within the Canadian 2001 legislation that provided for sunset clauses is historically the exception, not the rule, in anti-terrorism legislation. All of which means that the decision to invoke extraordinary legal measures to counterterrorism means that the government is making a political choice, not a legal choice, and not a strategic choice. And it's important to understand that it is a choice and the drivers of that. And if we understand it purely in legal terms, I think we miss a critical part of what's going on here.
Hi, I'm Margaret Prudy, and I'm from the University of British Columbia. I have to say, for someone who checked out of terrorism studies and issues 4 years ago, I think Dr. Wedgwood did a brilliant job of identifying some of the most complex and certainly persistent legal issues which do plague counterterrorism efforts around the world, and as well as highlighting the enormous variances among countries in counterterrorism approaches in their laws. I really don't have any interest in challenging her, and I don't feel I have the qualifications to question her either. My background is not as a lawyer or a political scientist. I come from a background of being a policy advisor and an operational manager of counterterrorism programs in various parts of the government of Canada. So rather than commenting on her remarks, I think I want to zero in and perhaps add to the discussion, zero in on the Canadian context and on the question of whether Canada's domestic counterterrorism laws constrain or enable, as the theme of this conference asked us to do, constrain or enable not only counterterrorism policy, but also counterterrorism operations. And I'll remind you that in this country, until 2001, terrorist activities only appeared in one statute of Canada. I hope the lawyers in the room confirm that. That was the Immigration Act, and it was in a long list of reasons why you could be declared inadmissible to the country. But there was not a mention in the Criminal Code, no mention in the National Defense Act, the RCMP Act, or the CSIS Act. And if we fast forward to today, we do have an Anti-Terrorism Act. It was put in place in record time by Canadian standards in late 2001. And we are developing a considerable body of experience with it in court. We also have many other new counterterrorism programs since 9/11 established under other laws. We have our own Canadian no-fly list now, for example, established under our Aeronautics Act. And I think importantly, what I want to focus on is, I, from my perspective, we find ourselves in a situation today in Canada in which legal issues and the legal framework for counterterrorism dominate whatever public dialogue we have in this country, and it is fairly limited. It's not always as dynamic as it is in this room, I'll assure you. It is focusing on this public dialogue about counterterrorism focuses about the performance and the credibility of organizations with counterterrorism policymaking and operational mandates, but it is the legal issues and the legal framework and the legal the various court cases and judicial decisions which are really flavoring that public dialogue to a great extent. Certainly Canadians in the room will be familiar with the number, fairly large number for us, of counterterrorism prosecutions which are either underway or completed against Canadians accused of engagement in terrorism, either court cases in Canada or in particular the UK. We also have had detailed examination in court of a large number of security certificate cases, to the point it's probably unlikely that we will be using those much, if ever, in the near future without some major changes. We've also had, obviously, a number of charter-based challenges to various actions on the counterterrorism front and the overturning of some aspects of the Anti-Terrorism Act as a result. We've had a number of significant court decisions, including several out of the Supreme Court. Canadians will also be familiar with three commissions of inquiry which have been underway in recent years. One is still underway, centering on a terrorist attack which occurred 24 years ago, and the two others focusing on the torture of Canadians in Sudan, Syria, and Egypt. And you may also know that was a rather extraordinary move, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court gave a speech in this city about a week ago focusing on the excesses and cautioning against any excesses in counterterrorism actions. So against that background, I want to just pose a number of questions. There are things that certainly I think about and are questions we may want to ponder in this country. First is, what are the implications, and we see this increasingly, of drawing intelligence agencies into legal issues such as disclosure and evidentiary standards and the testimony of intelligence personnel in open court proceedings? The former director of our domestic intelligence service referred to this as the judicialization of intelligence matters. What's happening to the counterterrorism boundary line between intelligence agencies and law enforcement? What will be the longer-term operational impact on the sheer volume and complexity of legal issues that are facing, and I have to say preoccupying, organizations with counterterrorism mandates and responsibilities? Do we have underlying systemic problems that have led to this situation where questions of law and legal challenges are so dominant? Why do some of these issues, deportation, detention, security certificates keep plaguing us? Are there weaknesses in our internal control systems? Are there weaknesses in our external scrutiny by Parliament and by various review and oversight agencies? Why do our laws seem inadequate to deal with recurring counterterrorism challenges? Certainly one that Dr. Wedgwood mentioned, the deportation of persons who clearly pose a national security threat, but against whom criminal charges are not possible and can't be laid. And what to do with persons who are subject to deportation orders when no country on earth wants to receive them. Another question is whether the dominance of legal issues has or is having or will have a chilling effect on the way that counterterrorism organizations manage risk, which is at the heart of their decision-making. And I guess I certainly would echo Dr. Wedgwood's question of, have we parked some of these tough issues in this recession from the trauma and the shock of 9/11? And one that bothers me greatly is, are we paying enough attention to the challenges of tomorrow in terms of legal challenges that are going to confront counterterrorism organizations, particularly as both criminals and terrorists take full advantage of every single advance in technology and telecommunications? It's one area certainly where current laws in this country are constraining, I think, counterterrorism and criminal investigations. There is legislation introduced in this country referred to as lawful access legislation, but that type of legislation has been worked on for probably close to a decade. Hopefully it will pass, but it does constrain, in my view, a growing component of counterterrorism investigations. And finally, public confidence. What's the impact of all this legal churn and controversy have on public confidence in the government institutions that are charged with countering terrorism? And will restoring or maintaining confidence and trust be especially difficult in this country, where illiteracy about security, intelligence, and terrorism is much higher than it is in many other countries? Thank you.
Thankfully, we haven't posed too many questions for Ruth to look at. But Ruth, if you'd like to take a few minutes to respond. Thank you.
Well, I'm afraid I'm more like Gordon Brown than Tony Blair in my capacity to take on something new at question time. Bless him. But I guess it's just a couple of thoughts. One only, clearly proportion is everything. I agree with that. I can make that my second use Kogan's principle, in the attempt to extirpate private violence, if you have public violence, when you're dead, you're dead. And public violence is in some ways more troublesome morally, I think, because it makes certain moral claims and then betrays them. So too much of a good thing is a bad thing, or too much of a bad thing is, anyway, it's proportion is clearly important. I take your point about once it becomes a part of the fabric of the law, it's harder to get rid of it, and that's indeed why one uses sunset provisions. The Diplock courts persisted in Northern Ireland for decades, although there really was a problem in trying cases in Northern Ireland if you had didn't have some cognizance of the fear that in a small community a jury member would have about the possibility of retaliation against him for having sat as a juror. So I do take the point. I certainly don't deny it. What's different, though, about this, what I think animated 9/11 on both sides, is just this flabbergastation at the failure of deterrence. It is ultimately societies live on sociability and love, and barring that, on deterrence. And you should have an actor who really didn't seem to be deterrable because he was motivated by unworldly concerns was quite dismaying. We are much more accustomed to dealing with homo economicus than homo, I don't know what to call it, but eschatologicus, some kind of eschatological ambition. What do you do with those folks? You can't deter them. All you can do is nip them in the bud, incapacitate them somehow, but that assumes a kind of omniscience that sounds Orwellian. I know exactly what you're thinking, and you're going to do. And that's where I think many people found a problem. I wouldn't, however, simply say that all violence is equal. Private violence is very tragic. But when it's not sheer body count. We lose in the U.S. 100,000 people a year to homicides, believe it or not, and 50,000 people a year to auto accidents. So 150,000 is, you know, normal terms of trade. But there is something peculiarly dismaying to the moral body politic when it's done with panache. I think, strangely enough, Stockhausen's shocking comment that what a great sound and light show 9/11 was, aesthetically exciting, certainly sounds perverse, as he put it, to me at least. But it did capture something, which is it was this, like this wild public execution of 3,000 people pulverized like some movie about the Martians, that it was the very, arrogance of the act that I think made it both shocking and capable of undermining all public confidence. If you could do that, what couldn't you? And then there's Dr. Kahn. It's the failure of deterrence, it's the Stockhausen effect, and it's Dr. Kahn. But back when I was doing a little piece in 1998 on the Sudanese airstrikes, and was al-Shifa a bad target, good target, and what about the camps in Afghanistan? And I began to read a little bit around Phibus. And what I've come to learn, by the way, for all you Perry Mason persons, now that I knew a little bit of what used to be classified, it's interesting to see how classified information filters out from all countries' services into public sources. Without sources, it's probably bottlerized, but I don't any longer take lightly what I read in the press, as our reporter last night would have indicated. It often comes from inside. And if you read around Al-Hayat and Al-Arabi and a number of the Paris and London newspapers in 1996, 7, 8, it did tell about interest among many parties in WMD, including a meeting, allegedly, I'm not testifying it happened, God knows, between one of bin Laden's kids, one of Saddam's kids and a representative of bin Laden for co-production. But I do think that A.Q. Kahn and the pervasiveness of the dissemination of nuclear technology, weapons technology, the seeming inability to keep anything segmented, both did and appropriately did increase the huge sense of alarm that, yes, the Western civilization would certainly continue if there was a nuclear explosion in Los Angeles. But I don't think there are many ways of knocking the stuffing out of a society, of destroying its self-confidence. I always often wonder, I'll sit down in just a minute because I'm riffing here, but why is it the British took tail from India, from Palestine, so immediately after World War II? Yes, they were exhausted. It was a terrible war. But they'd also, I think, lost any sense of confidence in their ability to succeed. And there is something to that. Societies have psyches and egos. And I do think that the consequence of having hundreds of thousands of people die in a nuclear explosion would be sufficient that it would be a very grave setback to call everything, globalism, humanism, optimism, capacity to plan, willingness to plan. There is such a thing as a kind of depression, psychic depression, I think, which holds the societies back. And that's why failure of deterrence, A.Q. Kahn, and the importance to a humanistic tradition of being optimistic about the world that made this such a dismaying event, and therefore one that was not just a normal little IRA pub bombing in Ireland. So it's not surprising to me that people did feel shocked, and one that need not endorse overreaction and yet can understand its roots.
Thank you very much, Ruth, and our panel.